When the United States Constitution was signed, the population was 4 million. It's now more than 300 million. Philadelphia was the nation's largest city with 40,000 inhabitants. Bad. Money Machine. Show 124, Friday, August 22nd. Hello, everybody. This is Paul Douglas Boyer. Thank you for downloading the Mad Money Machine. Yes, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the Constitution. Yeah, I think I'm going to have the Constitution Minute on every show. I'll tell you about my trip to see some of the originators, the original father of the Constitution's house. Yes, and I'll tell you about the author of the Declaration of Independence's house. The Madman Machine is proud to be sponsored by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com. Can I tell you a little bit about our day trip that we took yesterday? We woke up, got in the van, and drove south a couple of hours to go see Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home. Now, let me just tell you that before we went on this trip, we were wondering, is it really going to be worth it to take an entire day to see some old house? You know, I mean, we've seen around here in Leesburg, you take a house tour, you kind of walk through it, you see old stuff. You leave and you say, you know, what good was that? But this really exceeded our expectations. The tour guides make it come alive as they explain everything in the house. You can have any question answered about the house or about Thomas Jefferson, you know, answered by the two tour guides. We took a tour inside the house and then we took what they call the plantation tour, which actually focused a little bit more about the slaves that Thomas Jefferson owned. Yes, he owned up to 600 slaves over the entire course of his ownership of the Monticello property. Talked about all the stuff that went on at Monticello, all the things that they grew, and the crops and so forth. And on years when natural crops didn't work out, Thomas Jefferson actually had another really good crop, and that was making nails. Some of his more experienced slaves would make nails and sell them to the local craftsmen, I guess. And some of those nails were used in the other house that we went to see, about 25 miles north of Monticello. Do you know what it is? Montpelier, the home of James Madison, the father of the Constitution. And this was also above our expectations. If you ever get a chance, if you're ever in this area, Charlottesville, Virginia, University of Virginia area, definitely got to go see Monticello and Montpelier. Now, the thing about Montpelier, it was owned by the DuPont family starting about 100 years ago. And, of course, without having any respect for history, they just plastered over the brickwork outside and added all kinds of wings and things and rearranged rooms inside the house. Well, the last of the DuPonts finally died off about 5 or 10 years ago, and so the Historical Society became the owners of the property, and they have ripped out all the new stuff. They've recreated the house back the way it was, restored the old brick, restored the roof line. Thomas Jefferson helped Madison put on a deck on the second floor, basically, above the first floor of each of the wings outside, and that's very impressive. And what they're doing, they're actually going to finish this restoration project on September 17th of this year. And do you know why that date is special? Well, that's the date of the signing of the Constitution in 1787. And there'll be all kinds of people, dignitaries and so forth, at this house on September 17th. They're hoping for thousands of people, I'm sure, to visit. We were there when the attendance was very low, Some of the kids, I think, are already back in school, so we were able to get a very personalized tour of the place. They hadn't put any furniture or anything on the wall yet. They were still actually painting. Some of the walls hadn't even been painted yet. So they've got a lot of work to do in the next few weeks at Montpelier. And it's interesting to hear the stories about how Thomas Jefferson and James Madison would help each other out and come stay at each other's houses and play chess and so forth. What a life it must have been being the owner of a big plantation over 200 years ago. Cost of Government Day has finally come and gone. July 19th this year was when the last day that you had to work to pay the government. Now you're making money for yourself. Congratulations. Hope you enjoy the last few months of the year. Cost of Government Day is the name that the Americans for Tax Reform gives to the date of the calendar year on which the average American worker has earned enough gross income to pay off his or her share of spending and regulatory burdens imposed by government on the federal, state, and local levels. Why is the Cost of Government Day so late? July 16th? They say the driving factor for this is the fact that all the components of the cost of government, federal spending, state and local spending, and regulation are now increasing faster than national income. Here's a breakdown. Federal spending, the average American worker will have to labor about 83.7 days to pay for federal spending, which is now consuming 22.9% of national income. State and local government spending, the average American worker must labor 50.5 days to pay for state and local government spending. Costs of regulation. The average American worker must labor 62.6 days this year to cover the costs of government regulation. Unfortunately, these expenses continue to grow faster than the economy until advocates of liberty and small government become effective enough to change the country's directions. Spend crazy politicians will continue to bring us ever later cost of government days. Let's pull something out of the Mad Money Machine tool crib. Well, you know how sometimes you're sitting at your computer and you come across a long article that you just love to read, but you don't really want to sit there at your computer and read it. Or maybe you're at work and you come across something and you say, I'd like to read that later. Well, if you have an iPhone, here's the way to do it. Sign up for a free account at Instaprint. Instaprint, instaprint.com, and add a little button inside your browser. When you come to a page that's interesting, and by the way, sometimes what I do in this case is I will say print the page, and sometimes it takes you to a page without all the advertisements and everything, and that's the page I'll hit Instaprint on. Anyway, you hit the Instaprint button. Basically, it puts it in a bookmark-like online service at Instaprint. Then on your iPhone, install the application from the App Store called Instaprint Free. Then on your iPhone, when you bring up this tool, Instaprint, and log in with your same email address, you will get a list of all the articles that you have said that you would read later. And one of the neat things is it converts it to plain text and gives you the ability to zoom in and out on the text and read it later. So if you're waiting somewhere, you can pull up Instaprint and read one of the longer articles that you've been waiting to read, that you've put in your queue to read later. Now, what's a good source of articles? Try going out to ifa.com and look in the library section. A lot of interesting articles about investing there that are in the long form. Something that I'm sure you'll be interested in reading. Also, go to lewrockwell.com, lewrockwell.com. He has a blog site, but there's also a site that has postings of longer form articles. And they're just a whole lot easier to read on the iPhone, I find. Instaprint, it's a way to stay informed wherever you are if you have an iPhone. And like most of the other tools I've given you so far, Instaprint.com is free. That's what I want. And now for three stories about baseball. Well, my wife decided we needed to do something before school starts, and we decided to go to the Baltimore Zoo and then see an O's game, the Baltimore Orioles. She looked online, and it was, coincidentally and fortunately for us, it was Discount Tuesday. Tickets only $8 to see the Boston Red Sox. So after the zoo, we finally found a place to park, and at the ticket window, when we finally got up to the window, the lady said, "How many tickets would you like?" We said, "We'd like three of the Tuesday discount tickets." And the lady said, "Well, I'm sorry, we're all sold out." And we looked at each other, and she said, "Now, I do have three tickets together for $55. And my wife said, "You mean each?" The lady said, "Yes, that's right. Or I also have standing room only tickets for $10. I quickly said, "I'll take the standing room only." Once we got over to the standing room only area, which is just out over the wall in the right field section. The wall is, by the way, is about 5 feet tall there, if you're going to stand up and try to watch the game. So if you're 6 feet tall, you have a chance of seeing some of the game. And we're not that tall. So we were in despair, needless to say. We were thinking about just turning around and going back home. And I said, "Now, wait a minute, follow me." And I got the bright idea to go up to the farthest reaches of the stadium, way out in left field, way up in the upper deck, and look for a big empty section. And we plopped ourselves down in a virtually empty section. Seats on the end. It was just us in the entire section about a half hour before the game. We see the usher escorting about four people up the stairway, and wouldn't you know it, their tickets were for exactly that same spot. And so he said, "You know, you can move down there a little bit." I think he knew our little plan, our little scheme. And we did find some seats and enjoyed the game from nosebleed area, always looking at people walking up the stairs and wondering if they're going to try to claim our seats. Well, that was probably a bad experience at Oriole Park at Camden Yards, but the best experience I had was 10, probably 11 years ago, when we did get to see the game where Cal Ripken broke the record for most games played, the longest streak of most games played, 21-71. Every seat in that stadium was filled. The president was there. That was when Cal Ripken made his lap around the field, giving everybody high fives. We got home about 3 in the morning that time. One other baseball story. When I was young, we got to see the Cincinnati Reds play a really exciting game. We left in the 21st inning with the score 0-0 and listened to the rest of the game on the radio as we drove the 2 hours home. The Learning Earning segment is sponsored by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com. We learn how to earn our financial freedom using the markets to our advantage. This material is taken from IFA.com's website and the book Index Funds, the 12-step program for active investors by Mark Hebner. We're still looking at risk in the month of August. This time we're taking a look at the time diversification of risk. Charles D. Ellis said the average long-term experience in investing is never surprising, but the short-term experience is always surprising. Now I'll have some figures, and I'll have links to the figures, which illustrate the famous quote by Ellis. These charts, they show 50 years of returns on monthly, quarterly, annual, 5-year basis, and on 10-year basis. And they help you better understand the time element of riskies, the language of risk. The question is, does time reduce risk? For many years, the questions generated a lot of debate among academic researchers and investment professionals. On the one side are those who believe that the risk involved in holding stocks is reduced the longer the investment time horizon. This belief is based on two facts. First, as the investment time horizon lengthens, the actual average annual compound return achieved by a stock portfolio converges to its expected returns as the period of measurement changes from monthly to every 7 years. The volatility of returns reduces, that's the volatility reduces, and the existence of a losing period diminishes. So these figures show that the chance of incurring a negative return declines as the time horizon lengthens. In these studies, the chance of negative returns virtually disappeared when returns were graphed every 5 years. This long-term horizon phenomenon occurs because the risk or standard deviation of holding an all-equity portfolio drops by 67% when extending the investing time horizon from 1 year to 5 years. After 10 years, 78% of the risk has been eliminated. These are fantastic charts to look at. They plot the monthly returns of five of the index portfolios, 10, 30, 50, 70, and 90, 10 being the least risky portfolio. And you can see that the monthly returns gyrate all over, above and below, positive to negative. If you look at returns quarterly, you still see above and below the line of zero. Then in the third chart, if you look at the annual returns, the whole chart kind of slides upward to show that there's a higher average annual return, fewer negative returns. If you look at five-year annual rolling period returns, then there's only two that are below zero, and that's only for the portfolio 90. Everything else is positive. And finally, the 10-year annual rolling period returns. Everything's positive. In fact, the lowest one is 5%, the 10-year annual rolling period return. So if you think you're in tough times now, just wait. Wait and wait. Stay invested. Forget about what's happening day to day. Learning, earning. For more details, I encourage you to visit Index Funds Advisors' website at ifa.com. And once you've visited, take their risk capacity survey and then sign up for an account with them. Let them help you manage your financial freedom. Would you do me a favor when you sign up for an account with them? Would you email me just to tell me that you did that? Send it to feedback@madmoneymachine.com. And also, would you tell them that I sent you? I'd appreciate it. A very quick list of books and movies that I've seen and read the past few weeks. Stephen King on writing. World Made by Hand by James Kunstler, the author of The Long Emergency. This is a fiction book, World Made by Hand. It's set about 10 years after the collapse of civilization, basically. Saw Batman The Dark Knight. I saw The Bank Job. Saw Juno. Saw Kung Fu Panda. And saw Matilda. All of them recommended. Tell me if you've ever heard these words before. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. If you said that's our Constitution, then you're exactly right. That's the preamble to the Constitution. And it continues, in order to form a more perfect union and to establish justice and to ensure domestic tranquility and to provide for the common defense and to promote the general welfare and to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do what? To do all that stuff, what do? We ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The preamble basically establishes the fact that the federal government has no authority outside of what follows the preamble as amended. We the people is one of the most quoted sections of the Constitution. It was thought by the Federalists during the time that it was written that there was no need for a Bill of Rights, as they thought the preamble spelled out the people's rights. I'm Paul Douglas Boyer, and that's your Constitutional Minute. So everything you thought was going to happen in the markets went exactly the wrong way, didn't it? You thought the dollar would continue going down, didn't you? You thought that gold and silver would continue going up along with oil. You thought at $140 a barrel that it would go up to $200 a barrel. And gasoline at the pump from $4 would go to $5, didn't you? You thought financial stocks, even a month ago, when they hit bottom, you thought they would continue going down. But guess what? In the short term, you were wrong. The dollar rebounded significantly against major currencies. Gold and silver dropped precipitously. Oil dropping precipitously. Everything you knew was wrong. What do you know now? Oil's going to continue falling. Gas prices are going to continue falling. What's going to happen to gold and the dollar? What's going to happen to stocks? If you feel like you don't know the answers to these, or you feel like you've been wrong about the predictions in the past, well, join the club. Every single person on this earth that makes predictions about what's going to happen is right no more than half the time on average. Let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll the marble. And for the selected guru, give you a little background on their investment philosophy. So here we go. And the winner this time on Madman Machine Show 124 is Nuria Rubini. I got an email from Rita. She says, Paul, don't miss this article. I'm still shivering in my shoes. I can't remember. Has this guy ever been a guru on the show? Well, you know, Rita, no, he hasn't been a guru selection on the roulette wheel. But I did read a doom, gloom and doom quote from him a few shows back. But it's interesting that he has come up on the roulette wheel this time. She is pointing to an article in the New York Times, which I hope you've seen it. I've seen many references to it from people all over the place. The article is entitled Dr. Doom by Stephen Mim. It starts out by saying that on October 7th, 2006, Nuriel Rubini, who's an economics professor at New York University, he stood before an audience of economists at the International Monetary Fund and announced that a crisis was brewing. In the coming months and years, he warned, the United States was likely to face a once-in-a-lifetime housing bust, an oil shock, sharply declining consumer confidence, and ultimately a deep recession. He laid out a bleak sequence of events: homeowners defaulting on mortgages, trillions of dollars of mortgage-backed securities unraveling worldwide, and the global financial system shuddering to a halt. These developments, he went on, would cripple or destroy hedge funds, investment banks, and other major financial institutions like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Well, the audience, of course, in 2006 was the high times. Every day stocks were going up, right? The audience was skeptical and dismissive. As Rubini stepped down from the lectern after his talk, the moderator of the event quipped, I think perhaps we'll need a stiff drink after that. People laughed, and not without reason. At the time, unemployment and inflation remained low, and the economy, while weak, was still growing, despite rising oil prices and a softening housing market. And then there was the espouser of doom himself. Rubini was known to be a perpetual pessimist, what economists call perma-bear. But Rubini was vindicated. In the year that followed, subprime lenders began entering bankruptcy, hedge funds began going under, and the stock market plunged. Declining employment, a deteriorating dollar, ever-increasing evidence of a huge housing bust and a growing air of panic in financial markets as the credit crisis deepened. Well, I'll have links to the entire article in the show notes of this show. What's he saying now? And what does he think we should do? The first step that he told the author of this article is to acknowledge the extent of the problem. He says, we are in a recession, and denying it is nonsense. Though he's confident the economy will enter a technical recovery toward the end of the year, he says that job losses, corporate bankruptcies, and other drags on growth will continue to take a toll for years. For months, Rubini has been arguing that the true cost of the housing crisis will not be a mere $300 billion, which is the amount allowed for by the housing legislation sponsored by Representative Barney Frank and Senator Christopher Dodd, but instead it would be something between $1 trillion and $1.5 trillion. But most important, in Rubini's opinion, is to realize that the problem is deeper than the housing crisis. He says reckless people have deluded themselves in that this was a subprime crisis, but we have problems with credit card debt, student loan debt, auto loans, commercial real estate loans, home equity loans, corporate debt, and loans that financed leverage buyouts. All of these forms of debt, he argues, suffer from some or all of the same traits that first surfaced in the housing market, which is shoddy underwriting, securitization, negligence on the part of the credit rating agencies, and lax government oversight. We have a subprime financial system, he said, not a subprime mortgage market. And as for going toward the future, he argues that most of the losses from this bad debt have yet to be written off, and the toll from bad commercial real estate loans alone may help send hundreds of local banks into the arms of the FDIC. He says a good third of the regional banks won't make it. In turn, these bailouts will add hundreds of billions of dollars to an already gargantuan federal debt, and someone, somewhere, is going to have to finance that debt, along with all the other debt accumulated by consumers and corporations. Our biggest financiers are China, Russia, and the Gulf states, he noted. These are rivals, not allies. The United States, Rubini went on, will likely muddle through the crisis, but will emerge from it a different nation with a different place in the world. He says, once you run current account deficits, you depend on the kindness of strangers, he said, pausing to let out a resigned sigh. This might be the beginning of the end of the American Empire. Well, I'll have a link to this article, like I said, and I'll also have a link to his website where he blogs about the state of the economy, and you can read it for yourself and get updates from him in email. It's free, but you do have to sign up for an account. Congratulations, Nouriel Roubini. You're the guru on Madman Machine Show 124. I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy summer vacation schedule to download the Mad Money Machine onto your device or onto your computer and having a listen all the way to the end of this show. Thanks so very much, faithful listeners and new listeners both. This is Paul Douglas Boyer saying it takes money to make money. And you know, since it's been 2 weeks since I did a show, it takes better late than never to make a Mad Money Machine. I'll see you next Friday. Until then, please visit our sponsor, IFA.com. Some music on this program was provided by music.podshow.com. I would appreciate your feedback emailed to me at feedback@madmoneymachine.com, or even better, I encourage you to call the voicemail line, 206-734-4763, and leave me a voice message. Visit the website, too, madmoneymachine.com. Or sign up for instant alerts at twitter.com/madmoneymachine. I sent out a couple of messages saying that shows would be either delayed or late recently. Stay invested, everybody, in these risky markets.